Ann Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are. It's July 18th, 2012, and I'm very glad to be here today and to be back. I've actually missed several weeks here from It's All About Food, and I've missed you. So here we are for the next hour talking about my favorite subject, food, and all things related to food. All right, so before we get started with today's program, I wanted to remind you to visit my nonprofit website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. responsibleeatingandliving.com. I know it's a mouthful, but it's a good, nutritious, delicious mouthful. So spell it all out and give us a visit. And my email is info@realmeals.org, and I love hearing from you, your comments, your questions, anything at all. I hope wherever you are that you're comfortable. I know it's been particularly sweltering in New York, and because of a number of turn of events, I've been in San Jose, California for the last few weeks, so I haven't been experiencing that heat wave, and I'm pretty grateful for that. All right, let's move on to my first guest, Jay Rosengarten. He's the president of Olasor, Inc. He's responsible for the marketing and distribution of the company's extra virgin olive oil in the United States and Canada. He's the founder and president of the Rosengarten Group, and he has over 35 years of hands-on management experience in the retail and food distribution industries. Welcome to It's All About Food, Jay.
Nice to talk to you today.
Hi, I know that you've got some traveling plans going on there, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today on It's All About Food.
Well, that's my pleasure.
Okay, so we're going to be talking a little bit about olive oil today, and I think a lot of people have, like wine, we have very romantic images about wine and about olives. I'm not exactly sure where that comes from, but I think some of it has to do with the beauty of just seeing olive trees growing.
I think that that's right, and I think for years the image of olives and wine grapes coming from the Mediterranean part of the world kind of fuels all of that romance about both products.
Right, so tell us about, I don't even know if it's pronounced, is it pronounced olive, olive?
Olive.
Olive.
Olive & Co., and our other brand is called Santiago. And, you know, the wine analogy is really a perfect way to describe the two of these olive oils. It's very interesting because our product, by the way, our farm is in Chile. And so we will be actually one of the largest estate growers and producers of olive oil in the world from Chile. And when I mentioned that to lots of people, their initial reaction is, I didn't know they grew olives in Chile, but I like Chilean wine. And the truth of the matter is, we have very similar climates in Chile to the Mediterranean. Mm. So it was a very natural place to expand into the olive business. And the founder of our company, who is just a wonderful, wonderful individual, dedicated to the environment as well as his businesses, about 10 years ago, was traveling through Spain and Italy and looking at the way they produced olives and grew olives and produced olive oil, and frankly said, I think we can do that better in Chile. And he was correct. I mean, he brought the group of experts from all over the world together. At that point, not olive oil experts, but primarily agri-experts, climate, soil, irrigation, and the largest olive tree nursery in Spain, and asked them three simple questions. Can I grow olive trees in Chile? Can I grow olive trees that will produce a very, very high-quality olive oil? And can I do it productively? And the answer to all three was yes, and with that we went out and we bought our first farm. And that farm today has been producing olive oil since about 2008, and our olive oils have won over those short period of time probably 20 international gold medals from Italy to California as being classified best olive oil in their class. And, you know, it's a long way of saying we produce a very, very good excellent olive oil. We're recognized now around the world for that. But we sell it at a very fair price. We want people to enjoy it and consume it. And the truth is, most of the olive oil that we purchase in the U.S. Doesn't come from a single source. There's this notion for many years that if it's Italian, it must be great. But I just challenge people to take a look at the most popular brands and look at the back of the bottle and see where they're from, and you'll find that none of them come from Italy. In fact,
right,
they come from multiple countries. And the reason for that simply is that they consume more olive oil in Italy than they produce. So I always ask myself, where does all this Italian olive oil come from if they're consuming more in Italy than they produce? But having said all of that, our olive oil comes from our farm. So we can actually trace the oil in our bottle back to the tree. So it's not only back to the country, but we can trace it to the farm and we can trace it to the tree.
I think that's so important, especially today in this crazy global market that we're in. There are so many food products where you really can't get back to the source, and that has so many, can have so many repercussions related to
exactly.
That. I wanted to mention that I lived in the south of France in the early 90s for about 4 years, and I just couldn't get over the flavors in the olive oils that were available there, and most of them were from Italy and Spain. And then I came back to the United States, and it was so hard to find an equivalent good tasting olive oil. You know, I found a few, and certainly Italy and Spain are usually the places that I go to, but I have tasted your Olive product, and it is really delicious. And like wine, like you said, there are, in a good olive oil, there's a lot of depth. There's that fruitiness that I'm always looking for.
Correct.
And
various degrees of what I call pepperiness. You know, it's fresh, it's grassy. And it's interesting because I think the analogy to wine and flavor and olive oil is the same. You know, I mention to people all the time, I said, you know, if we're talking about wine flavors, if I were to say to you Cabernet Sauvignon or Pinot Grigio or Merlot, very specific flavor images pop into your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true because, frankly, the California wine folks, when they became on the world scene, needed to differentiate themselves from the European producers. So what they did is they started to name their wines after grape varieties. So all of those are grape varieties, and we know that today, pretty commonplace. But if I were to say to people Abbasino or Abbasano or Frantoio or Lacino, most people will look at you with a blank face, and those are varieties of olives.
Mm.
And like wine, each olive variety has a different flavor characteristic.
Right. So what are we getting in the Olive? What variety is
that? Well, Olive, it's a blend of Abbasina and Abbasano, which are the two traditional Spanish varieties.
Mm.
So I tell people that's a very typical oil that you find in Spain. But more importantly, it's an oil that's really meant to be used every day. It's a wonderful, fresh, clean oil, wonderful to cook with. It's wonderful to make a complex salad dressing or marinade where you're not really looking for necessarily an overpowering flavor of olive oil, but you're looking for it as an ingredient and something that's just going to enhance your dish. Our Santiago brand, on the other hand, uses the varieties of Frantoia and Lacino, which are the traditional olives found in Tuscany. So it's a much bigger oil. It's got a lot more pepper on the finish.
Mm.
And the pepper actually comes from the fruit. In the olive oil world, they call it bitterness, and I've always been reluctant to use that word because it, to me, conjures up bad flavor, but in fact, it's the pepperiness in the olives that you're tasting. Now, that oil is very typically used not to cook with, but it's used to finish with. So if you were preparing, you know, one of my favorite summertime meal dishes is fresh tomatoes and mozzarella.
Mm.
And if I took the Santiago and drizzled it over the top, you'd get such a wonderful flavor of the olive oil.
Right.
It complements the tomatoes and the mozzarella. It's just fantastic. And it's the same thing. You can use it with meat or fish. I use it in soup very frequently. But chefs tend to use that oil at the end when they're looking to create a dish that actually has the olive oil in it that becomes part of the flavor of the dish.
Do you have any recommendations about storing olive oil? Because I keep mine in the refrigerator because I don't like it to go bad.
Right. I don't think you need to do that, but I think you need to keep it at a in a room temperature dark space. I mean, in a cupboard, or in a you know, I keep mine on a canister. It's actually a stainless steel canister, right at the stove. But as long as light is the enemy, it's not temperature.
Okay.
Extreme temperatures are more the enemy than anything else, but light is really the enemy. And so you want to keep. That's why you see the better premium olive oils are all sold typically in a dark glass bottle, either a green or an amber or something like that.
Okay, I know I just have a few more minutes with you, but I just wanted to ask, what about the production of this olive oil? You know, we're all concerned about sustainability and the community,
right,
and the people that are growing it. What is Olisur doing with that?
Well, we're very dedicated to our land, and our production process is probably one of the most modern in the world. We grow the olives, we harvest the fruit, we press it into oil, and we store it all on our farm. Our factory is on our farm. So from the time we press the fruit, from the time we harvest the fruit to the time it gets transformed into oil, it's about 2 hours. And the result of that is that the acidity of our olive oil never exceeds 0.2%. And to be classified extra virgin olive oil in Europe, the acidity can be as high as 0.8%.
Mm.
And the difference in the acidity is telling, because an olive is a fruit. It's no different than a peach, a pear, a plum, a nectarine, a strawberry. The moment you pick it, you know, the question is, what happens to it? You know, very simply, it starts to decay.
Right.
And the longer it hangs around, the more acidic it gets. So the higher the acid level, the more defects in the olive oil, the more impurities in the olive oil. So the fact that we produce and we can guarantee, and we actually put it on all of our brands on the bottle, that it never exceeds 0.2% is something that's unheard of in the commercial olive oil business.
Well, so it's all in the taste, and you can definitely taste it's a very delicious olive oil.
Yeah, and it's fresh. And we, you know, we sell our olive oil out every year, so we guarantee that there's never stale olive oil in the market. The other thing that you mentioned was sustainability. We only produce extra virgin olive oil because we're committed to the land, as I said. So we take skin and the pulp from the olives after we've finished the pressing, and that's composted and used as organic fertilizer in the for the trees for the following year.
Very good.
We take the pits and we grind them and we use them as fuel for the generators that give the plant the electricity that we use. It's really a quite remarkable operation.
And where can we find it here in the United States?
Well, we're in 8,000 stores all over the U.S. We're in the Northeast. We're in ShopRite and Stop and Shop and Giant. We're in A&P. We're in Christie's in New York. We're in Price Chopper. We're in Big Y, just doing this from the Food Emporium in the Northeast. In the South, we're in Winn-Dixie and Harris Teeter. We're in all of the Kroger divisions, so it would be all of the Kroger stores on the East Coast. We're in Ralph's and on the West Coast. We're in Smith's. We're in Fry's in Arizona.
Okay, you know your store. It's just about everybody.
And we're in Loblaw in Canada, and the list goes on, and it's growing literally every week.
Can we come to Chile and visit, get a tasting?
Absolutely. It would be our pleasure. By the way, the time of the year to come to Chile is May.
It's May.
Because remember, we're in the Southern Hemisphere, so
right,
our seasons are the opposite.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining me, and it's all about food.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Okay, have a safe flight.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Jay Rosengarten of Olisur Inc. and the Olive olive oil product. We will be taking a quick break and be back with Daryl Lovitz. Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Welcome back. It's July 18th, and this is the second part of our show. And right now I'm going to bring on our next guest, Daryl Lovitz. She is the author of Muzzling a Movement, The Effects of Anti-Terrorism Law, Money, and Politics on animal activism. She is an adjunct professor of animal law at both Temple University Beasley School of Law and the Earl Mack School of Law at Drexel University. She was selected by Super Lawyers magazine as a rising star. Ms. Lovitz earned a B.A. magna cum laude from the University of Pennsylvania and her J.D. from Temple University Beasley School of Law, at which she was the recipient of both the Law Faculty Scholarship and the Barrister Award. She was selected by her classmates to be the class speaker at Temple's graduation ceremony. Ms. Lovitz was appointed special prosecutor by the Lancaster County District Attorney to prosecute the pivotal Pennsylvania case, Commonwealth versus Esmond Schad, in which the Elizabethtown District Court determined the criminal liability of a battery cage egg production facility owner and supervisor under Pennsylvania's animal cruelty statute. And there's so much more about Dara Lovitz. You can read it on ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com's website. But I just want to get talking to the amazing Dara Lovitz. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Hi. So all those lawyer jokes do not apply to you.
They don't apply to anyone. I take special offense to those lawyer jokes. I don't find them fair.
No, but you are one person who is doing wonderful things for the world, and I thank you for that.
Oh, I appreciate that. Well, thanks for all you're doing to educate the public on responsible eating.
Yep, and living, because
and
it's
living.
All one package. And so I am really curious. I know about this law that came into being a few years ago, and I was hoping that you could kind of enlighten us a little more about it. The animal anti-terrorism, actually, how is it? How does it go?
It's the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
There we go, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. I did read the law not recently, but I found it a bit confusing, and I understand that there are some kind of loose misinterpretations in it that have led to some problems.
Yes, exactly. Generally, the law prohibits the disruption or the interruption of animal enterprises, specifically causing damage to them, either economic damage or causing fear in the workers at the animal enterprise. And animal enterprise is a very, very broad term. It includes any entity that, I guess the way I would define it, is any entity that exploits animals, whether it's for their flesh, for food, their bodies for science, their skin for fiber, for leather and fur, and even entities that exploit animals for entertainment purposes, entertainment in air quotes, of course, circuses, rodeos, zoos. And technically, because the wording is so broad, it could include almost any company, because almost every retail business in the United States in some way exploits animals or has some connection to animals. So it is very broad in whom it protects, and it's broad in the sense that it's attacking anybody who opposes these entities for their exploitation of animals.
Do you know the history of how this law came about?
It has so many iterations that go back to the late 90s. Originally, Congress was focused on environmental, quote-unquote, radicals, and they started some laws, eco-terror laws, to combat the environmental radicals. And at some point, they started to become fearful of a new burgeoning movement, and I wouldn't say it was a new movement, but it became more known, the animal rights movement specifically, when animal rights activists started to liberate animals from mink farms and fox farms. And when that happened and economic damage started to become more widespread against animal entities, Congress put together a statute that then included animal rights activists in these eco-terror laws. So it's had several different iterations, the Farm Animal and Research Facilities Protection Act, and then the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which became the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. So the history goes back, but the most offensive and most constitutionally insufficient statute is the current one, Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. I mean, it has become so much more restrictive. The penalties are harsher. It protects so many more entities, and it really prohibits the free speech rights of animal rights activists.
So we live in a world that does a lot of exploitation, and unfortunately there are laws that encourage it or at least don't prevent or discourage it. And a lot of people accept it as day-to-day activity, but we know what goes on in the factory farms is, I don't even like to use the word humane because I don't know what it means anymore, but what goes on in factory farming is horrific. What goes on with animal testing for a variety of different purposes is horrific. So much of it is unnecessary. And so we're dealing with something that is considered acceptable to some degree in our society, and so it's really hard to fight against it and get the law on your side.
It is, and you're absolutely right. The way the laws are written, it's really to protect facilities that do this. And, you know, we have animal cruelty codes. In every state, there's an animal cruelty law, and it's really good if you're a dog or a cat. But if you're any other animal, those animal cruelty codes do very little to protect you. In each animal cruelty code across the country, there's a common farming exemption, which basically says that while you can't rape a dog, and that would be animal cruelty if you did so, if you rape a cow, that's okay because it's part of a common farming practice. That's what they do on farms, and that's okay. So usually livestock, agricultural animals are protected, I mean, are not protected under these animal cruelty laws. So, yeah, the laws are written with a very speciesist slant and a very industry protective slant. And that's something we're battling, and we've always had to battle. But this Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act takes it a step farther by saying, not only do these laws protect these entities that exploit animals, but if you oppose the laws, if you speak out against them, if you cause economic damage to these entities who are exploiting animals, now you've committed a crime of terrorism. So it really brings this, it raises it to a very scary level with regard to civil rights.
Now, I don't believe in violence to achieve an end, and I know that lots of wonderful things have happened as a result of violence, and lots of horrible things have happened as a result, but I kind of take the Gandhi route. There's more to this act. It's not just about violence. It's about speech.
Exactly. And you're right to bring up violence because it does technically cover violence, but it also covers speech. It covers economic boycotts, which is civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience. And I would say most of the people that would be harmed by this statute are those that are part of a nonviolent movement to educate the public about what happens on these facilities, in these what these entities are doing. So it really, the problem with it and the constitutional problem with it is it covers nonviolent speech activities, which are constitutionally protected. And technically, the animal rights movement has been a nonviolent movement in principle. You know, the principles of ahimsa and, mm-hmm. like you say, the Gandhi route. It really is about nonviolence. It's nonviolence to all creatures, human and non-human. So this definitely targets more so a nonviolent group for nonviolent activities.
Okay, now since the most recent revision of this law came into place, has it been used?
It has been applied. The big one that's been applied, and it was applied in California in the Buddenberg case, and that was challenged, and ultimately those charges were dismissed because the police and law enforcement and the district attorney or the U.S. attorney who was filing the charges was not specific enough. So it was thrown out not because the AETA is unconstitutional, but because the charges against the alleged criminals, the animal rights activists in this case, were not specific enough. And you have to be very specific when you're filing criminal charges. More importantly, the big case was the Animal Enterprise Protection Act's application to the Shack 7 Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, a nonviolent animal rights group that was trying to expose the horrors that were taking place behind closed walls of the Huntington Life Sciences, which was the largest animal testing lab in Europe and had a branch in New Jersey of the United States. So that was where it was most offensive because six animal rights activists who were nonviolent and did nothing, well, there was no direct evidence that any of them did anything illegal. They were thrown in federal prison. for an aggregate of about 23 years. So each one served a couple of years in prison.
But wasn't there some, I mean, I'm remembering this goes a while back, I remember there was some, like, explosion or something in a parking lot or something in California?
Oh, possibly.
Some pharmaceutical company or something like that? Wasn't that related to this case? I'm digging in my vague memory, so I can't.
I'm wondering if there was Walter Bond. Yeah, and I'm not sure. I don't know what happened with the prosecution because I didn't hear anything further about that. Yeah, there were a couple of bombings, and then there was an arson attack. But again, I don't know much about the prosecution, and I don't believe that the AETA was challenged on a constitutional level for that. The AEPA, its predecessor, was challenged constitutionally and made its way up to the Supreme Court for the Shack 7 case, but the Supreme Court denied cert. In other words, they said, we're not going to hear this case and we're not going to decide on it. And that basically upheld the highest court, which was the Third Circuit of the United States, their affirmation that the AETA was not unconstitutional.
Okay, so is there anything happening to change this law or things that we should really be concerned about with regard to it at this point?
I think the concern is what I've stated, that the Constitution is being rewritten to prevent equal rights for animal rights activists. As far as what to do to change it, the Equal Justice Alliance is a great nonprofit who's working to undo the harm of it. I think a Supreme Court challenge would be a good route. We've tried to, we wrote a position paper for Dennis Kucinich, who is very supportive of repealing the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and unfortunately he's no longer able to help us in that regard. So it would be great if we could find another congressperson who would be willing to spearhead the efforts to repeal it.
I guess
it.
We just don't know, because it's out there so broad, we just don't know when someone might decide to use it against something really innocent.
Right, and honestly, a lot of people say, well, I'm scared because I'm trying to get people to stop buying this product, and will my economic boycott result in a conviction under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act? I truly believe that if they used it against us in a very obvious way, in a way that was very obvious for us that we have free speech protection, then it would get knocked down. So I think the police and law enforcement will be selective and are going to be selective in how they use it. They're not going to convict us for standing outside and passing out flyers and causing economic damage in that way. So I think the more it looks like free speech activity, the safer we are. While the AETA technically might apply to the activity, if law enforcement actually uses the AETA to convict us, I think that would be a huge PR problem for them, and it would give a really good constitutional challenge to the AETA. I don't know if law enforcement would want to present that opportunity for us to then challenge them constitutionally and say, see, this is why it's unacceptable. Yeah.
And then the other one is ag-gag bills. Boy, that's almost a tongue twister. Ag-gag bills. Agriculture gagging bills. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because they seem to be popping up all over the place.
Yeah, and you know, for years, a couple of states had similar laws, ag-gag bills. That's what we call them, but obviously they're not known by the industry that way. They basically prohibit the recording, or they criminalize the recording of video or pictures at an agricultural facility where animals are being used for food, raised for food, or killed for food. And it just creates a new criminal act, a new code for specifically people who do this. And it obviously targets animal rights activists who have made a good history of going onto factory farms and other facilities to take video footage and then disseminate that footage to the public or use that footage in an animal cruelty case against the actual facility. So it's really targeting, again, the animal rights movement. And so a couple of states have had them on the books for a while, and most recently Utah and Iowa added ag-gag bills, and other states try all the time to get them passed, and they don't pass. So so thankfully we're only dealing with maybe about 5 states total that have them. And I think the issue is there are it's twofold. I hate the fact that it targets the animal rights movement. Again, here's another law that says animal rights activists can't do what they've been doing in the way that they need to educate the public and stop the harm that's happening to animals on these facilities. But the other issue with it is it's a public health concern. I hope that you find with your audience, generally people want to know the origin of their food, where their food comes from.
Let's just stop right there. I mean, that's mm-hmm. part of the problem with the food industry today, because most Americans don't care what's in their food.
Is that what you found?
Yeah, I mean, I think my audience cares, but I don't think most
yeah.
people care.
Yeah, or they don't want, you know,
I interrupted your train of thought there. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. I guess I'm more optimistic about it. I think people want to be educated generally. You know, with that pink, was it the pink slime?
But that was just because, you know, all of a sudden the media was harping on pink slime. People have no idea what's in their food, but they started getting hysterical about pink slime because the media told them about it. But if they cared, they would know that there's... It's not just pink slime. Pink slime's the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the horrible things that are in people's foods.
Yeah, I guess I was hoping that the public outcry about that was proof that the public does care.
Yeah.
But I don't know. You're in a better position than I to know that. But I guess in the end, I was hoping that what I don't like about these bills is that they prohibit more information from getting to the public. So any videos that support the pink slime argument or any videos that support that pigs are cruelly treated before they wind up on your plate as ham, those videos will not be disseminated to the public. And I personally, as part of my journey to become vegan, videos were huge for me,
mm-hmm.
Seeing the suffering. And I could hear about it, but I'm a visual learner, and that's just the way I roll. And seeing the images in the pamphlet and then watching video was so instrumental in my transition from an omnivore to a vegan. And I think it's important. I think those videos are important. So it's not just important for animal rights and for veganism, but also just for public health, making the public aware of where their food is coming from. It can't hurt.
Oh, I really believe in those things. I think they're very important, and I think we need to see them more frequently, and then maybe people would be more concerned. But they're not as concerned because they don't hear enough. Occasionally they'll hear something in a 5-second soundbite or something on television, but if they heard it every day, all of a sudden it would kind of be elevated in their list of things to worry about.
Definitely. And if we get the right video produced the right way and we can disseminate it on Facebook or something and have people
mm-hmm.
watch it,
yeah,
you know, that's all we – or let the Today Show cover some 2-minute segment that we can show. But, again, those videos will not be published because those videos won't be taken because of these ag gag bills.
Now, I know that people are still doing undercoverage footage of different facilities. Have these bills, do you know, have they been used to prosecute anyone?
Not that I know of, because I actually don't think anyone's been caught yet in the states where they exist. And
mm-hmm.
And let's hope that we keep it that way.
Right. Interesting, I was speaking with Sue Koh a few weeks ago, and she's done a lot of incredible artwork. Excuse me. And she said that one of her strategies, I don't even know if she realized it's a strategy, but she'll talk to people and ask if she can, people who work inside these facilities with animals, and she'll ask if she can draw them. And is there anything in the law that says you can't do paintings or drawings of what's inside?
Is she drawing the people who work there?
No, she's drawing anything she sees within the facility.
Let's see. Yeah, that could technically, it depends how broadly the statute is written.
Mm.
But if it's, a lot of the times it's saying things like recording images. Technically, by writing it down, you're recording the image.
Yeah.
But
it's
some
not clear,
statute,
I guess, which particular facility it's in, because it's artist rendering, but it's really an interesting way, the way she gets into these facilities, because they basically just invite her. Sure, you're just drawing, and she says, I can show you what I'm doing, and she's made some, I don't know if you've seen some of the images that are in her newest book, Cruel, but very fascinating work.
Oh, that sounds great. And that might be a little different. If they're inviting her onto the premises
mm-hmm.
for the purpose of recording, then I think she would be clear.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we have to be a little clever this way rather than
exactly.
maybe going.
Anyway, it's what's going on is horrible, and clearly the laws in many instances do not support what I think is really right and just.
Right. We're battling a bunch of people and lawmakers who just don't see it the way we do, and that's tough. And they have power, and frankly, the lobbying industries, the lobbying groups who represent these industries that test on animals and exploit animals are so powerful and have so much money, and unfortunately that money goes a long way with influencing lawmakers.
I'm just curious. Now, you teach animal law at two schools of law. What does that consist of, animal law?
It talks about the conflict between laws that take into consideration the interest of humans and how they can balance the interests of non-human animals.
Now, I'm imagining that people coming from a different perspective would present these courses in varying different ways.
Yes, there is a lot of variation. The Animal Legal Defense Fund has a wonderful resource for animal law professors, and we could technically all teach the same course the way we'd want to, but there's a lot of leeway, and I think we all put our personal spin on the way we teach the course. I know some animal law professors don't show videos. They don't show videos of animal cruelty. They feel like it's imposing horror and violence on the students and putting the students in an uncomfortable position having to watch them as part of the class. And I'm the other way. I think videos are so powerful, I show them in class. I usually give a warning. But I also ask my students in the beginning of the class whether they've watched any violent movies like Gladiator or Saw or Hostel. And my feeling is if they've been able to expose themselves to human suffering in these fictitious movies, of course, but if they're okay with watching blood and guts, in the human context in a movie, then they should be, in my mind, and maybe my logic is flawed, but they should be okay with watching blood and guts on video when it's about animals. Now, the difference is one is fictitious and one is real, and it's hard for me to logically get over that issue. But I think that's
part of the problem. I think because we view so much violence, fictitious or otherwise, it makes us really numb to the reality of it.
It really does. We're very desensitized. However, I find that people seeing video images of animal suffering are affected by it. They're not desensitized to it. And that's a redeeming factor.
Yeah.
That is, it's hopeful. So anyway, the point is I do show videos to my animal law students and not every animal law professor does it. So we really do teach our classes with a very personal touch. But thankfully, university...
Are all animal law professors vegan, or are they coming from different points of view?
Yeah, they're not. And, you know, I battle this all the time. I'll be invited to speak at animal law conferences, and the free lunch that's given to faculty has turkey wraps and tuna sandwiches. I'll speak personally from the Pennsylvania perspective. The Pennsylvania Bar Association or the Pennsylvania Law Bar Institute has me speak, and their position is animal law is not animal rights law. It's animal law. So it technically includes lawyers who are defending farmers and lawyers who are defending breeding facilities. And technically, that's true. So animal law is not animal rights law, and animal law professors are not all vegan. Nor do they all teach from an animal rights perspective. And I, personally, am not allowed to teach animal rights. The deans in both law schools have been very specific that I'm to teach a very neutral animal law.
Now, that was my next question. Yeah, how did the deans handle what you're doing?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, they see who I am and they read my biography, and that's the first warning I get is this is not a chance for you to stand on a soapbox and preach. And it's very important that you allow. And I think that's important because the students, and this is what the deans have said, they want to feel comfortable. They don't want to think, I'm not vegetarian, I'm not vegan, therefore if I attend this class and speak in class, the professor will penalize me for my views. And that cannot be. You know, and I've been very careful about teaching the course very neutrally. The grading is completely anonymous. And in class, I do bring in our industry arguments. I realize that when I talk with a bit of a an advocacy slant. You know, mm-hmm. I know that it comes out. It can't not come out. It's so part of me. It's so ingrained in me the way I discuss things. And that might not be fair to the other students who don't necessarily agree with me in that position. So I always make sure that I have the industry perspective represented. Either I have students go to their websites, you know, the Animal Agriculture Alliance website, or I'll have a speaker come in who can give, you know, a position opposite of mine. So I try to make it as balanced as possible.
Have some of the students come to you outside of class to find out more about being vegan?
Yes. And this is a little, I hope you don't think this is manipulative, but I always come to class with vegan cookies or vegan cake, something that I've made, because it's a night class, and my justification is you're tired, you need sugar, you know, you need something to stay up. So I usually bring, you know, a vegan dessert.
Yeah, manipulation. I support it.
Yeah. So
why not?
So they have, you know, so a lot of times students are asking me for recipes or they want to know how did I get this to taste like this without butter and dairy. So there's a little bit of vegan outreach that I try to do subliminally. And
the most effective vegan outreach is by mouth, feeding people delicious food.
I think so. I think it's been helpful. And honestly, the videos have really helped students see what they've never been exposed to before. I usually have at least a student or two go vegan after the course, which is so validating for me. And again, because I'm teaching the course from a very neutral position, it's them just taking information and thinking about it a little bit further.
Do you have some favorite videos? Favorite may not be the right word, but the videos that are the most provocative, the most compelling?
I've used Farm to Fridge the past two semesters, which I think is a Mercy for Animals DVD. It's about 12 minutes long, and I show most of that. I used to show Earthlings, but one of my students pointed out, and didn't even occur to me, but there's a science portion of Earthlings, and the scientists look like they're from, the video footage must be from the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, the scientists are wearing these Coke bottle glasses, and they look so dated. And the student's interpretation of that was, well, if there's no modern footage, how do we know this stuff is still going on?
Right.
So I didn't think about that. And I like the 70s style, so maybe, you know. But so I didn't realize that, so I stopped showing that. I also show a lot of clips from sharkonline.org. Shark, the group, has some good clips on rodeo cruelty. And I find little clips here and there that I find that are effective for the students. I try not to make it too long. You know, it depends what the issue is. And then honestly, you know, Jon Stewart, The Daily Show, has some funny clips, and I like to show them as well to lighten the mood, and so the students don't think every time I turn off the lights in the classroom something horrible is about to come.
Right. That's important. All right. Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and I thought we could touch on some of the other things that you're working on. So I know in New York City we have one of the tourist attractions. Mayor Bloomberg, of course, thinks it's a very important tourist attraction. That's the horse-drawn carriages. Do you have them also in Philadelphia?
We do.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we do.
Have they been there a long time? I don't ever remember seeing them.
Well, you know, that's a good question, because people who defend them say it's part of our tradition. In fact, it wasn't until the late 70s with the bicentennial celebration that mm-hmm. the mayor brought them back to Philadelphia. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they weren't part of our quote-unquote tradition in Philadelphia. They weren't a historical part of Philadelphia. And, of course, that was a way of transportation, you know, centuries ago. That's how they transported. I understand that. We have very narrow streets in some parts of the old city, which show little – there are these little metal iron things where you wipe your foot from the horse dung. I mean, this clearly was a horse-traversed town, but mm-hmm. but not for years and years. And the horse-drawn carriage industry as a touristy thing in Old City just came in the late 70s. And but they are a pretty big part of Old City, Independence Hall, in that area.
Right. Well, you know, when I think of New York City, horse-drawn carriages don't come to mind. I mean, they're not on my list or anywhere
right.
near the top. You know, I'm thinking about culture, Broadway and the arts and Lincoln Center and the Metropolitan Opera and all of the great museums and all of the great food and the Statue of Liberty and on and on and on and on. And horse-drawn carriages is just like some little speck that isn't really important. I don't understand why it's such a big deal, and yet it is. In the grand scheme of things, I personally prefer talking about the factory farming of animals because there are so many more that are involved. It's true that there aren't many numbers involved when it comes to horse-drawn carriages, but it's something that's very visual and definitely unnecessary. And where are we in this movement of getting rid of it?
Getting rid of factory farming?
No, getting rid of horse-drawn carriages, you know.
Okay. Yeah, and to your point, it is a single-issue campaign, and my nonprofit group, Peace Advocacy Network, generally avoids it. We really do try to promote veganism and educate about veganism, but it's so obvious in Philadelphia, and frankly, we've been able to get a lot of people to read our literature about veganism who show up at our horse-drawn carriage demos. So we've used it as a way to do vegan outreach as well. I know that sounds a little counterintuitive, but there are a lot more Philadelphians who are opposed to the horse-drawn carriage industry than are vegans. So we can interest them in horses and understand why it's cruel to the horses and then educate them about other animals that are also subjected to cruelty. In Philadelphia, we have this, we had a council person who was very supportive of the industry. A lot of his campaign dollars came from the horse owners. There are two main companies that run these horse-drawn carriages. He is now out of office, and we have someone new who's pretty liberal and progressive, and we're so hoping that that our letters and our efforts are going to be instrumental here. We've already drafted a ban. We have legislation at the ready. We have dozens and dozens of signatures from business owners, because we know that's where the money and the tax paying comes from, or the business owners in Old City, Philadelphia. So we have letters from them supporting our efforts to ban horse-drawn carriages. We have constituents. So we really, we're trying to create a very strong campaign to get this ban passed. And we recently had an accident where a horse got spooked, surprise, surprise, and bolted, and then a car hit the horse, and the horse became injured, and the car driver was injured, which really is what gets the media attention when the human is injured. Because horses they're injured every day that they're out there on the streets, and nobody covers it. But the second a human is involved, then the media gets onto it. So we have a demonstration scheduled this Sunday to bring light to that accident and why horse-drawn carriages are just unacceptable and unwelcome in Philadelphia anymore.
Oh, I'm just taking a big, deep breath here. There's so much that we need to do, and I never understand why people support exploitation, pain, suffering, cruelty. So let's all breathe together for a moment.
Yeah, I wish I had the answer. These are the things that keep us active as activists.
Yep. What else would we do? Gosh. I like to think about that. You know, if we weren't doing this work, what an incredible world this would be. And let's see. So you have a nonprofit, Peace Advocacy Network. What's going on there, and who takes advantage of that?
We have a couple of missions, and we believe they're all interconnected. One is to promote veganism. Another is to promote social justice. And then the third arm of it is protecting the Earth's resources. We believe environmentalism, social justice, and veganism are all interconnected. We have separate campaigns. We have an LGBTQ campaign for social justice. We have a human trafficking campaign and feeding the hungry. But they're related to veganism. They're related to compassion and peace and nonviolence. And I think the environmental connections I don't need to explain so much with veganism. So we have a bunch of different campaigns running at the moment. And again, people will show up at our a gay rights demonstration, and they have no exposure to veganism, and we're able to give them some literature that helps them understand, or we'll have a social event after the demo at a vegan restaurant, and we connect all these issues because again, it has to do with compassion. Speciesism is not so far from homophobia, and it's not so far from these other social justice issues out there. With regard to feeding the hungry, we have contributions of fruit and vegetables to lower-income neighborhoods because we believe that we need to give them access. Right now they have access to the Burger King and the McDonald's, and that's about
it. Mm-hmm. You know, about racism, homophobism, speciesism, sexism, I get it. I get that they're all connected. But unfortunately, I think those who decide they're being exploited under one of those somehow tend to want to slip into some hierarchy and feel that their issue is not the same as another issue and that you're insulting them by saying it is. I remember protesting at a Ringling Brothers circus event outside of Madison Square Garden, and there were people that were really annoyed when we tried to connect the issue of human slavery to what to animal exploitation, and they were really insulted.
I've run into that too with circus demos, that we have a big placard that does make the comparison, and I understand it's a very deep and personal topic, and the people who are offended are usually the ones who don't think about animals very respectfully, and they think that they're being compared to animals, which to them is an insult. I personally would love to be compared to these brave, sentient creatures whom we've exploited, and they love us unconditionally for some reason.
Isn't that amazing?
That's
what they do, and how do they do that? Love unconditionally. This is something that we really need to learn how to do. Maybe that's why the animals are here, to teach us that.
I don't know. They're here to teach us something, we're not getting it. So yeah, I do find that once in a while, and you have to be very careful because I don't want to lose audience members. You know, I don't want to lose people who might be open to our message otherwise if we didn't use that rhetoric. So we try to be very careful when we're towing that line.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left, and I'm just looking in things that I might talk to you about. And one of them that's talking to me right now is breed discrimination. What is that, and what are the animal laws related to that?
Breed discriminatory laws are typically laws against certain breeds in towns. I mean, they're really not, for the most part, they're not statewide. It's a town ordinance that says that you can't have a pit bull or you can't have a Rottweiler in the city limits. And sometimes it's not saying that you can't have them, but it's saying if you do, you have to have them muzzled in public, or you can't let them out, you can't have them on a leash in a public area. I mean, there are all kinds of restrictions, and they're specific to the breed of the dog. As opposed to just saying if your dog has bitten someone, regardless of its breed, then you have to muzzle the dog. That's different. That's a dog law, and that's pretty accepted across the country. But it's vague as to the breed, whereas these breed discriminatory laws say that if it's a pit bull, if it's a Rottweiler, and there are about, there are a lot, maybe a dozen different dog breeds that are criminalized specifically. And what's ridiculous is that law enforcement has no clue what a pit bull is versus another non-pit animal. You know, they're so bad at identifying. I mean, there's been so many studies done showing them images, and the officers have to identify what's a pit bull and what's not. I mean, the fail rates are ridiculous. So it's not even enforceable. These laws aren't enforceable, but they're also they're so harmful to pit bull owners. And I think people who have pit bulls would agree they're such generally friendly dogs. I mean, look, there are pit bulls who attack just like there are little Jack Russell Terriers who attack. It all has to do with behavior and discipline and background, the history of the animal. So it's so ridiculous that a whole breed should be discriminated against when it's it's really dog specific, not breed specific, as to whether a dog is violent.
I mean, we have the same problem with human beings, okay? There are some that cause a lot of problems.
Yeah.
What do we do about them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we just have a minute left. Anything you want to share with us before we sign off?
Well, I really appreciate the time to discuss these issues. I encourage people to check out the Equal Justice Alliance and learn as much as you can about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And any time that there is a broadcast, an email saying, contact your senator, contact your congressperson, now's the time, do it. I think those things go a long way. And I just hope that your listeners take action when they have opportunities to do so.
Yep, it's up to each one of us individually. Do as much as you can. Thank you so much, Dara Lovitz, for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen. Take care.
Okay, have a great day. And thank you, all of my listeners, for joining me today. I'm Karen Hartglass. Check out my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and have a very delicious week. And please stay cool. Bye-bye.